From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 143 with guest Kevin Klein, recorded Friday, January 8th, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you very much, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, everybody. Richard, once again.
I'm doing a speedy opening this morning. What can I tell you? I'm fast.
Speedy. Speedy Gonzalez.
Feeling speedy today. Absolutely. Well, without further ado, hey, let's just jump straight into the show. There's lots to talk about here. I've got Kevin Klein with us today. Kevin is the Technical Strategy Manager for SQL Server Solutions at Quest Software. He's also a Microsoft SQL MVP and a founding board member of PASS. That's the Professional Association of SQL Server Folks.
Great conference they put on.
Absolutely. And the author of several books, including SQL in the Nutshell from O'Reilly. Kevin is a top-rated speaker in industry trade shows, been active in the IT industry since 1986, which is just making himself sound old. And a good friend of mine, too. Kevin, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, we always end up talking about SQL Server stuff anyway. What's on your mind these days?
Well, you know, there's so many things happening with SQL Server that are fun and exciting. You know, one of the things, if you paid much attention, you've probably seen that there's been a bit of a acceleration in the release schedule. So, you know, we had a really long delay between 2000 and SQL 2005, but we've only had maybe 24 months between SQL Server 2008 and the CTP for SQL Server 2008 R2 come out. So, you know, that's interesting, and that produces a lot of opportunities for us to learn new things and to, you know, to see what's coming ahead from Microsoft.
And I realize that the 2000-2005 thing was not the SQL team's fault. I remember then they were ready earlier, and it was the WIDBI, the new UI, that was really holding them back. You know, it's funny how those things sort of happen, that they get these delays and stuff gets stretched out. Now I worry that we're too fast, that you know, folks are like, oh my God, another version already? Are you kidding me?
Right. You know, that is a great point. And from an enterprise IT perspective, you know, which is my background, you know, really big, you know, multi-hundreds of SQL Server shops, this is a huge concern and something that I bring up to, you know, my colleagues at Microsoft through the MVP channels and just, you know, through personal relationships. I bring up quite often because one of the biggest issues for an enterprise IT shop is just controlling change and change management. And so, you know, 24 months is rapid enough for IT shops to start considering maybe we're just going to deploy an update every other release.
Right. Let's skip a version.
Exactly.
You say change and immediately I think of the mantra, change is good, you go first.
Perfectly said. Yeah. So, you know, so many IT shops, they want to see how everybody else fares first.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't afford to be a pioneer. I don't need arrows in my back, right? You know, let me know how that works out for you. And if it's okay for you, maybe I'll come along as well. Is there stuff in R2 that really matter, you think?
Well, you know, and I asked myself that same question, really. And that's something I'm always really keen on because I used to be a very hardcore Oracle person. I used Oracle for many years as the author of SQL in a Nutshell. I really keep track of the pulse, keep my finger on the pulse of both DB2 and MySQL. And so, you know, I always want to know where they're going. And for quite a while with Microsoft and SQL Server, I had difficulty perceiving their strategy overall with the new features and new releases because, you know, adding more features sometimes, you know, doesn't help stuff. It doesn't necessarily make the product cohesively better. You know, it doesn't advances it here or there, but not cohesively better. And I saw a cohesive strategy with Oracle because, you know, they were buying applications. And although they definitely have been advancing the database, you could see that they had kind of a strategy that included, let's get all the ISVs and all the big application vendors on Oracle. And that's going to drive a lot of database adoption.
Right.
And, you know, so what's driving database adoption for SQL Server besides, a great price? And it actually really crystallized for me with SQL Server 2008 R2. I was a little bit surprised. I thought there was my big aha moment when they introduced at the past conference, they showed this new feature called Power Pivot. And it's for, and it's an, you know, an add-in for Excel and SharePoint and whatnot. And so what they have been doing in release after release after release, of course, the database engine itself has been getting better, but they have been adding almost an order of magnitude more BI features, you know, so each time analysis services would get much more powerful, you know, then a release or two ago, they added reporting services and, you know, that became a very potent way to get your data out. And one of the things they saw with the integration with reporting services and SharePoint and whatnot was, you know, huge proliferation of power users starting, you know, making use of data, but in a very uncontrolled way. Power Pivot is a feature now that just very, very good cohesion between the relational engine passing that data to the BI engine, and that BI engine then handing it off to users, power users, who normally would be uncontrolled, and now we can control it. We can give them huge amounts of data. We can, you know, make sure that their data is up to date, you know, that it's not somebody with an access, you know, database in some dark, shadowy corner of the organization. We can actually keep tabs on them and, you know, kind of make them part of the team. So what they have done, and I apologize for the long discussion there, but what they have done is they've really brought BI right there to the desktop. You know, they had talked about it kind of passing before, but the aha moment for me when I saw the demo was that this is really what they have been promising in terms of business intelligence for years, that we can actually enable, you know, the best information for, or what's the old term, the right information to the right person at right. the right time. And it really does that.
Well, and man, Microsoft's always seemed to struggle with the client side of BI for some reason. They had some opportunities there, and I guess they're going to land on Excel. And I sort of like the ad hocness of that you can just sort of pull some data. It's not too formal. You can do some reporting. But I agree with you. The biggest thing for me is these data fetches secured? Are they auditable? Like, do we know who's grabbing data and how?
Exactly. You know, and one of the experiences I had, and probably both of you have seen at some point or another in your careers, is somebody, you know, somewhere at their cube is a, you know, just a smart user. They start clicking away. They, you know, they get a password to this database or that, and they pull their own data down. They have their own little Excel spreadsheets or Access database. And, you know, the manager in the, you know, the cube down the hall sees how successful that information is in empowering that person. They're like, hey, can I use that too? And pretty soon, there's not just one or two or three copies. There's like 12,000 copies of this right. around the company. And it's completely out of control.
Well, it's also, that's when you discover that he left off a major chunk of the query and they're working from wrong data.
Exactly. Or, you know, half of the people who are using it are using, you know, his second iteration. And then, you know, the other half are using the 15th. And so there's huge disparities.
Yeah. And he's now become his own little IT department.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, man.
It's just like the change stuff we were talking about a moment ago. It introduces, you know, just uncontrolled change. Yeah. And it can you can wind up spending as much time supporting that kind of stuff as the real applications that, you know, that your, you know, that your bonus plan is based on.
Yeah.
You talked about SQL Server and you know, adoption with these new, you know, the more frequent release cycle now. My experience has been watching development teams sort of looking forward to versions of SQL Server that are released or about to come and say, well, what can I do now that works really well? SQL Server quite often is really a foundational piece of an application, and a lot of the SQL Server, a lot of the requirements for building a software application from scratch sometimes are based on what SQL Server has to offer.
Exactly.
SQL Server 2008, gave us native transparent encryption that really changed the way that people are building, you know, secure applications that leverage SQL Server as a store. What are some of the things in the R2 release that maybe sort of fit along those lines?
Well, there's a few things that are kind of the flip side of that coin, which I find kind of interesting. Like one thing they've added, which they've talked a lot about, which is going the other direction, is something they've called Master Data Services. And, you know, at first when I looked at this, I thought, wow, this is kind of odd because Master Data Services is the kind of thing that very few enterprises use. You know, it's not something like every every developer would say, hey, I need to build this as a foundation into my product. This new application we're building. And what it does, Master Data Services, is it basically creates kind of, it's almost as much process and automation of kind of best practices around process for saying what data in this company is kind of the, you know, the official, the master copy of this data. So, you know, we're going to declare, you know, this particular database over here in its version of customers. That's going to be the master version, and everybody else has to derive their data from this master version.
Gotcha.
About customers. You know, this other database over here, this is the one that the SAP HR data module, that's where we are declaring that to be our master HR data. And this is a kind of platform that I see very few shops using, but I think that this is interesting to a certain percentage of Microsoft customers who, you know, are these kind of top tier Fortune 50 kind of companies, you know, very large government organizations who have been giving out their data to many, many different people and have found that, you know, one group of people call Hewlett Packard HP and then another group calls them Hewlett Packard, another group HP Inc. And so they have this terrible problem with data quality.
Right.
So that's one side of the equation, not quite the developer side of things. With the developer side of things, you know, I'm a little bit surprised with, there was a really, really strong and forceful effort at SQL Server 2005 release to really strongly integrate Visual Studio and SQL Server together. And they were even released on the same, you know, same schedules and whatnot.
Right.
And, you know, I was really excited and hopeful that we would see lots of things like, you know, much more integration with change management systems like, you know, Team Foundation Services, Visual Source Safe. Things like that. That didn't happen at the time, but like you're saying, we are seeing more robust features added that the developers can hook into and take advantage of. But
right.
My story there is a little, you know, I'd hate to use harsh words, but my story there is a little bit one of disappointment because there are some really, really amazing new features. Maybe a release ago, let's say like Service Broker, very, very powerful means of doing asynchronous messaging and transactions. But and it's something that developers could really make powerful use of. But some of these things kind of come out, I don't know if half-baked is the term, but you could take it so much further and make it a really strong launching point for developers to build all kinds of new services on. But I haven't seen them take some of these really, really cool things that developers could utilize to the next level.
I do find that developers generally don't know that there's anything in SQL Server other than SQL Server. They don't know about integration services. They don't know about Service Broker. They just don't know that all this stuff is in there. Like, there's no excuse. The latest version of SSIS, there is no excuse for you to write looping code to parse text files ever again.
great point. Right. Great point.
And but they don't know that it's there. We've done shows on the other side there on .NET Rocks with guys where we're saying, like, look at how good this is. You should not be writing this code by hand anymore.
Right. And, you know, and you bring up a great point, too, there, Richard, in that I think that they kind of, Microsoft kind of recognizes this in the way they've launched SQL Azure. You know, it doesn't have a lot of those services. And also, you can see pretty clearly with its launch that it really is targeted at the developers. I mean, they launched it at PDC. They didn't launch it at PASS or, you know, at TechEd for a broad and general audience. This is for developers, and it really just has the kind of things that you guys think of when you think of a database. Just the, you know, those kind of bare bones sorts of things.
Absolutely. You know, the other angle on this that I find interesting is that I agree with you that they went all that trouble to put the SQL Management Studio as part of the same tool set as Studio, and then it seemed like they kind of dropped the ball. But then along came DataDude, which is the version of Studio specifically for database folks that does allow us to check in the data structures, the schema and so forth as part of the source code and actually make us like a full-fledged member of the development team. But I don't see real DBAs using it because it's Studio and Studio is for developers.
Exactly. Right. You are 100% on the hit the nail on the head.
why buy Studio if I don't need to buy it?
Well, I think there's part of this is a licensing problem that folks just, you know, why am I going to go down that path? And, you know, Microsoft's now reorganized all the versions because that was what was happening, was that you had to buy the database edition. It's like you had to buy the test edition, and nobody wears one hat to have one version like that. So they've reorged all the versions in 2010. But I know I've been coaching developer, the one developer who can write decent SQL and actually get his way through a stored procedure, that sort of, that database developer guy, as opposed to the DBA who works with developers. That's the guy who ends up running this version of Studio, and he's generating scripts that then get fed to the DBA to evaluate to see if he's actually going to apply to the database. So that's sort of the way I've been coaching people to use this tool.
And that's what I see too, you know, so if you have a large team, let's say you've got, you know, five, ten or more developers, there's usually that one really smart guy with a database, and
yeah,
he's the one who gets the team, you know, the team foundation, database professional services, data dude. And he's the one guy who gets that, and then everybody else is still with Visual Studio.
Yeah. And it sort of gets left there.
Yep. And you're right. There are so many fantastic features in that product, too. It's a shame that they are not kind of released and distributed in a way that, you know, the DBAs themselves could take advantage of it. Or even, you know, exposed in a way that, a regular developer on the team could use those as well. You know, you bring up an interesting point. I hope you don't mind I segue towards that. But one thing that has been kind of interesting thing for me to watch is around licensing and pricing. One of the things that, if you harken back just a few years, you know, we all probably remember the days back when, you know, there was one phone company, and then it was broken up into several phone companies, PacBell and Bell South and all that. And that's kind of, if we use the old game board from Parker Brothers or Milton Bradley, you know, Monopoly, where there's just one company that runs the show. And then in Economics 101, we have something else called an oligopoly, in which there's just, you know, a handful of companies that kind of rule the market, if you will. And, you know, we remember that from the old telecom days. You know, there were the big three from Detroit. A few movie studios, for example, make 80% of the movies in the USA.
Right.
We really have that situation now very, very clearly, although it's not the kind of thing that a lot of people think about. It's very clearly happening right now with major database platforms. So at Oracle's big conference earlier this in 2009 in the summertime, they announced 35-40% price increases, and sure enough, in the fall of that year, I believe it was at the PASS conference, Microsoft announced, "Hey, here's our price increases." You know, DB2 has always been from IBM has always been priced about the same as Oracle, so there was a period of time when you could count on SQL Server being priced quite differently from Oracle. But I think that we're now entering a period in which it's very competitive with Oracle in terms of its market share now. And, so I think we're going to see things acting in a much more kind of oligopoly sort of economic situation in which if they raise their price, we'll raise our price.
Sure. Yeah. I totally agree. And it's just because there's really only three players that matter, right?
Exactly. And, you know, add in the fact that Oracle has bought Sun.
Yeah.
Or is attempting to, if the EU lets that stand, and MySQL now, who used to be kind of, you know, the Southwest Airlines of the, you know, of the price leader in terms of low end costs, you know, they're going to be owned by Oracle.
Yeah.
And so it's another situation in which you can see, hey, you know, if you never paid attention to those kind of economic trends or those large, patterns, you know, if you wanted to buy right now, a four CPU high end, you know, enterprise edition copy of SQL Server, right, it's going to cost over $100,000.
Wow.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Now, of course, that's list price. So, you know, if you're a big company, you can negotiate, you know, and there's enterprise agreements and SA software agreements and whatnot. But,
right,
you know, people think of SQL Server, as, you know, as a price leader. And I think it is definitely a price performance leader. But I don't think you can say it's just it leads solely on cost now, because those prices are definitely going up.
I think the other side of this is that SQL Server is so much more performant than the average app needs. You know,
yes. You know, and that's one thing I jokingly talked about when I was writing one of my last benchmark papers was I had, you know, have a little test lab and I write a paper and say, oh, you know, this and such offers a big performance boost over, you know, the old way of doing it. And I had real trouble even on my little two CPU, two core Dell box here with actually getting it to fail in terms, you know, pushing it too hard. It was performing so well that it took a huge amount of work for me to find out a way to, you know, to bottleneck it and make it throttle back.
To actually bury it. That's funny.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
You know, the other direction that I found interesting in the marketplace now is the NoSQL movement. It's this idea of,
yes,
I don't want a database.
You know, and I think we're going to see more of that too. And it goes back to, you know, what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, even with the tooling, with Visual Studio and DataDude and things like that. At the end of the day, a developer says, I just want to make this application work.
Yeah.
That's what I want. You know, I don't want to have to learn a new language. If I don't know SQL, I don't want to have to, you know, bury my head in that, learn how to do a good SQL statement. And so what we're seeing is there's quite a few, you know, it's a green field right now, so there's lots of new things popping up, but there are a few thought leaders. Hadoop is one. There's a couple other NoSQL databases out there. And they're attracting a lot of attention because they are a means by which you can access your data. Typically, these are especially good with unstructured kinds of data, you know, things like maybe XML documents or PDFs or whatever you might want to throw into them. And they're blazingly fast. They're non-relational. So that means, you know, they don't require a normalized set of tables or primary keys or any of those sorts of things.
Right.
That really, let's be honest, they're an obstacle for a developer to make their application run. One of the things that is interesting when you look at these non-SQL databases is they use a kind of technology called, it's called column storage. So traditionally with a relational database, they use what they call table storage. You know, we do things in rows. We define a table.
Right.
And what is happening actually with the R&D efforts at places like Microsoft and Oracle and DB2, IBM with their DB2 tool, is they're actually working on column store technologies themselves. So they want to be able to get to that position where they have these blindingly, blazingly fast column lookups for this kind of unstructured data as well. It was something that one of the keynote speakers from Microsoft spoke at PASS last year. His name is David DeWitt. And so the NoSQL movement, I think, when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, this is just, you know, kind of a group of angry developers who are like, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. But now that I start to think of it, about it and, you know, kind of analyze what's happening behind the scenes, I think there's going to be some legs to this. You know,
yeah,
there's going to be some longevity because it does deliver on what it promises, which is really fast and it just works. You don't have to learn a lot of new stuff. And it's the kind of thing that the other, you know, major database platforms are starting to pay heed to. Technologically, the really great thing about NoSQL databases is that they're easy to construct in a way that's memory resident, you
right,
know, stays in memory, and much more so than a relational database. And what we're looking at today with the current state of the hardware is the biggest bottleneck is going to disk.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if we add flash drives, that's still our biggest bottleneck. So if we can get more and more of the database to work in memory, we can achieve, you know, enormous scales of improvement. That's why it's interesting to Microsoft and Oracle and DB2.
But we're also risking the data. You know, I remember before relational databases, I'm dating myself now, when we were using hierarchical databases and network data stores and stuff where we had to walk the tree ourselves. And, you know, the relational database movement really focused on this reliability. I remember doing the test where you wrote a record, it said the record is written, and you'd pull the plug out of the machine. Then you'd power it back up, and it would show that, yes, when I say the data is written, it's bloody written. It is absolutely reliable. And these things
that's
aren't
right,
doing that.
You know, and that's the key to any of these new database systems. You know, they have to be cost effective. They have to be reliable, and they have to be secure. In other words, that they keep, you know, the wrong people out and they let the right people in.
Right.
And that's the challenge both for the NoSQL databases. That's also the challenge for any of the cloud database vendors too. You know, some of these different databases in the cloud claim to be safe and reliable and secure and whatnot, but they're not transactionally consistent. You know,
right.
you might lose a transaction here and there.
Yeah.
You know, as well as we have famously seen, you know, major outages of data because it wasn't backed up properly.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those same challenges exist on the NoSQL side. It's still very immature. So,
sure. Well, and as soon as you're working across the internet, you've got a reliability problem.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, there's just a basic weakness there. But I also think that, because I do a lot of work on high-performance systems, we routinely sacrifice reliability for performance. If you stick a caching layer between your application and your database, you've just, you know, broken your reliability of data writing. You're already doing that. Like, I'm realizing now, as we start looking at the NoSQL movement, that what they're talking about is stuff we're already doing. We just call it something else. We call
right.
it caching.
That's right.
You know, we already got a transactional integrity problem. We've just been ignored. We're willing to do that for that performance improvement.
Right.
Yeah. Once you have the data in memory, then work with the data in memory. There's no reason to keep going back to the disk.
Well, it's certainly not synchronously anyway. But
mm-hmm.
it is an interesting set of problems that I think from an IT perspective, trying not to just be the guy who always says no, there is the, hey, you know, we have a service level agreement here that says that these transactions are reliable. Are we still working with that? Are we, you know, compliant to this if we go this way? You know, there's another side to this that I think is starting to surface as well. That's actually, I think, a little bit older than the NoSQL movement. And it's really the whole ORM mindset, the object relational mapping mindset that developers are getting into, some of them at least, they're getting into today, where they're not building the database first. They're building the objects first and saying, just store this. Don't tell me how you did it. Just keep it. And when I ask for it back, give it back. And so you're literally having databases being generated off of the back of the object graphs of an application.
And in the long run, I think that's probably the way to go. You know, our computers and processors and things like that are getting so powerful now that it's the kind of situation where it seems like it would be possible that we could let the machines do more of that.
Yeah.
And that way we could spend, you know, more of our time trying to solve the business problems, which I think is, you know, something that sometimes gets lost in the mix of all of this, you know, and we spend our time and our brain power thinking about elegant and beautiful solutions.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing that drives me crazier than to see two DBA type guys arguing about, you know, whether their data model at third normal form is, you know, is the best one compared to this other guy's data model for the same database, you know, in second normal form or fourth normal form, you know.
Yeah. Well, you're right. We got that pounded into us, you know, in the 90s, and we just can't seem to let it go. So this idea that here's this database that's largely generated from a tool, and immediately the DBA in me starts screaming. But then I think, you know, I'm not going to report directly to that data. I've got an ELT load to a reporting database anyway. So what do I really care what the structure of the incoming data is? Just that's super fast for the app. It's totally self-managing. I don't need to put any of my resources into creating anything for it. It just happens. So I'm focused now on the transformation process that pulls that into a form that reports well.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
It's a different way of thinking, and it goes against the grain. The hair on the back of my neck is literally standing up. But I can't find anything really wrong with it.
Right, right. I think the old tradition is that, you know, we control and we know every step of the process.
Well, because we're being held accountable for it.
Exactly. But from the data, the DBA side, the thing that's funny to me is typically a DBA would typically not cede ground to an application that they knew was generated by automatically generated by a system.
They'd be horrified.
But they would happily go ahead and install a third-party application that was written by a company that has no idea what a join is.
Right.
And I see that all the time in our customers as well. You know, you go to their shop, oh, we're having a problem with performance on this particular application. And, you know, we get into the code and we see that it was, you know, it was really written for Oracle, but they're running it on SQL Server,
right.
You know, and so it takes advantage of, you know, Oracle's processes and you know, preferred algorithms and things. And it's like, what? So in a sense, we see many, many customers who do that. But just like you're saying, you know, the hair on the back of their neck would stand up if you suggested, you know, some alternative that really is the same thing.
Yes.
You know, you see to that control and that performance. But, you know, it just goes against the grain for them.
Yeah. When I think the same thing, going back to that NoSQL movement, is this whole, guys, this isn't that new. We've already been violating ACID rules within this application using caching layers. So just because we're admitting it doesn't mean it isn't already happening.
Oh, it's so very true. So very true. You know, and developers have been looking for shortcuts for a long time. I mean, one of the, you know, the most common questions I get when I speak at events like TechEd or, you know, one of the big conferences, people will, you know, come around and they'll say, hey, you know, what I really want to know is what is the syntax for slash faster?
You know? Where's the big red button?
Yeah, where's the little switch I can put in that says, just make SQL Server go faster and stop screwing around with me, you know? And so they're always looking for that shortcut. And like you said, also, none of this is new in the sense of the, you know, the theoretics of it. These ideas have been around since, you know, since the 70s.
Yeah.
Probably even before then, you know, everybody who's new to the field thinks that virtualization is the greatest newest thing, but, you know, we saw that on old IBM mainframes with MVS decades ago.
Yeah, it's true. I also have a sense, and I guess it's just been in this long enough, that we've swung too far over to the relational database. We store everything in a relational database, even stuff that isn't relational.
Yes, exactly. Just like you said, you know, certain things were pounded into our heads in the 90s, and this is one of the things about IT that is a bit of an annoyance to me, is that it's very kind of fad driven. You know, what is the greatest, newest technology? Oh, we all go there in a herd. We all make the same mistakes together and, you know, try to figure it out. And then 10 years, 8 years later, something else comes along and everybody runs over to that. So definitely something that I've seen as well.
It's fad driven, and, you know, and IT has a tendency to watch what everybody else is doing and to say, well, if everybody else is doing it, then that must be what I need to do, so I'll do that. As opposed to getting in and really understanding, you know, what is it that you're deploying and what is it that you're leveraging in order to get the job done.
A great example of that, for me, is outsourcing. You know, so many people jumped into outsourcing because that's what everybody else was doing. And then they wound up saying, oh, gosh, this is a disaster. And they, you know, they picked up and, you know, tried to rebuild their teams here in the States and so forth. And if they had thought about the whole situation from not what is everybody else doing, and then I better do what they're doing, but what is the business need, and what are the best options for our organization? You know, in a sense, my joke is I like to blame the airline travel magazines, because the CIO of the company happened to be sitting, you know, in a seat on an airplane flight, and he got a little bored, and he flipped open, you know, whatever the American Airlines or the Delta magazine is, and there's an article in there about some particular management fad or some kind of technology fad, you know, and there's CIOs all over the country right now who are beating up their staff saying, we got to get on this cloud thing. Got no idea why. It's just that was in the magazine when they were on the airplane, you know?
Right, exactly. What's the one message that you want people who are thinking SQL Server, whether they're new to it or it's old hat, that you want them to have right now? Maybe that we can use that just to tie up the show. We're pretty much out of time.
If I had one message to someone who was new to databases, maybe they were going to, you know, they had a successful startup, and what are we going to build our next generation platform on? What are we going to build our first generation platform on? My message to them about SQL Server would be that SQL Server has really arrived in terms of both performance and manageability. And with 2008 R2, we now have the opportunity to get that information to the right people, the right time, the right format, in a way that we've never been able to do in the past. So it's very, very powerful and yet still very usable for everyone throughout the company.
Kevin Klein, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.